Hey there, folks. This is Screen Watching recorded from the Screen Watching Studios on the 2nd of February, 2024. This is Groundhog Day. On the show this week, we've got a lot going on. We've got the movies. We will talk about The Argyle. We will talk about The Mean Girls. We'll talk about some TV shows. There's Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which began as a TV show, then became a movie, but now it's a TV show again. There's some conjecture in that. We'll dive in deep. Also, feud Capote versus the Swans, or is it Capote, or is it Capote? We'll discuss. And finally, we're going to talk about Expats, which is a show starring R. Nicole, and frankly, I wish it didn't. Folks, this is Screen Watching. I got you, babe. Yeah.
This is not like TV, only better.
Television! Teacher! Mother!
Secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Simon Foster, a happy Groundhog Day to you, sir.
Oh, look, it's good to be here on Groundhog Day, as celebrated around the world. Hello, Dan Barrett. Welcome, screen watchers everywhere. Welcome, groundhogs everywhere. We know we've got a lot of rodent listeners, so thanks for being with us. Are they rodents? Oh,
we're really big, in community.
Yes. Yes, we really are in community. I want to send a shout out, and this is going to rattle your cage a little bit, to Mr. Thierry Frémaux, the festival director of the Cannes Film Festival, for putting one David Fincher and Netflix in their place with his comments overnight as we record this from the Göteborg Film Festival, where he said, hey, Netflix are welcome, but on our terms. I think that's exactly how it should be. Dan Barrett, have you got a view on that?
Well, they said that a couple of years ago, but I think it's a little bit rich to say, hey, look, you know, you can participate in our film festival as long as you have it in movies, which is violating kind of what you're all about. Okay. But then it's really rich to turn around a few years later saying, oh, David Fincher, we love you. If you come back and play by our rules, we'll let you play by our rules. Like, it's just kind of just something gross. Either put the line in the sand and stick to your guns, or just freaking open the floodgates a little bit. I say, if it's a movie, if it has artistic merit, then maybe it should play. A movie in 2024 isn't governed by whether or not it's released in a cinema or if it's in a streaming environment or if it's released direct to video or gosh knows where.
Well, it is in France. It really is. They've got a condition in place that says that it there's got to be a window between the Cannes Film Festival and the French distribution, and that includes Netflix. And we should point out that Netflix are welcome to go to Cannes every year, just not in competition. And they're the ones that say, oh, no, we think our film should only be in competition. We won't be invited and then not
Simon,
be judged by the good
Simon,
people of the Cannes Film
Simon,
Festival.
It is not Netflix complaining. It is Cannes complaining that people aren't going to come and play by their rules. Frankly, I think Netflix is right not to want to compete, because there are lots of other film festivals that respect the idea that movies are changing and that your arbitrary rule, which can be broken. In fact, I believe the number one rule of rules is that they can be broken. You don't need to hold to it.
All right, so we've gotten this off to a bad start. If there's a film festival in the world that's going to stick to its rules, it's going to be the biggest film festival in the world, which is the Cannes Film Festival. The fact that Netflix want to be judged, have their works judged by the judges of the Cannes Film Festival, that shows exactly the importance of the festival.
That
is a festival,
Simon,
that celebrates
Simon,
cinema screenings. That's what they do.
Go back to the statement I made. Netflix aren't arguing for this. They're not wanting to be in competition because they won't let them be in competition. So they're not changing their rules. They're not changing their release structure to meet Cannes. Netflix have just said, no, oh, you don't want us. We'll just disappear. It's Cannes that are saying, oh, David Fincher, come back to us. Sorry, I should have done that with more of a French accent.
No, he didn't say that.
David Fincher, you come back to us now. We give you a bread roll. I got Italian then. I can't do it. I'm like Adam Driver
little Super Mario Brothers there. Yeah. All right, well, we'll continue this at some other point. No doubt this will fester away for a few months until something else prods the bear. So it's good to be here on Screen Watching with you, Dan Barrett. It's been a long week. We've had some highs and lows in our movie and TV watching, and I'm keen to get into it.
All right. Does that mean that we play a sting to enter our reviews?
It stinks.
Okay, Simon, I want to kick things off with a conversation about Mr. and Mrs. Smith. This was the Angelina Jolie, Brad Pitt movie that's been spun off into a TV show. But also, quietly, it was already a TV show. But we're going to talk about that in just a moment. This is a really fascinating TV show in that the embargo for critics only just lifted a few hours ago as we record this. Usually, if a movie is a complete stinker, which will probably bring us to Argyle, the conversation that we're coming up to after this, maybe we'll find out. Usually, if it's a stinker, the studio or streamer or whoever will say, oh, you know, no reviews up until like the minute that it gets dropped out into the world. Heaven forbid that you sell it.
Sure.
But the critics almost universally have really, really liked it. And it's weird to me that they've, you know, put this embargo in place. It says to me that Prime Video don't actually believe that much in the critical merit of this TV program. And instead, they're just kind of hoping that audiences will latch onto it, regardless what critics think. But the critics do really, really like it. It's fascinating. Anyway, let's listen to a clip of it. We'll come back on the other side. We'll go a bit deeper into what this thing is.
I'm Jay.
I'm John.
Love and happiness.
Banking card and marriage registration.
Something that can make you do.
We're married.
Yeah, I guess we're married.
Make you do right.
They didn't bring up that we'd be paired until the last interview.
It's an old KGB tactic. They draw less attention as a couple.
Very romantic.
Simon, I'm sure we all remember that time a few decades ago at this point where we first got exposed to Mr. and Mrs. Smith. We saw two of the hottest leads up on the screen as a spy. They're a married couple, but they're really secretly spies. And who will ever forget that moment that Scott Bakula looked into Maria Bello's eyes and we saw the sexual tension between the two. And then remember just nine years later when a movie ripped off the entire same concept and name, calling it Mr. and Mrs. Smith, but instead this time it starred Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. Who could forget those moments in our lives? But it's okay, because now we can wash all of that clean with a brand new Prime Video series starring. Okay, sorry, Simon. What are you trying to butt in with?
Well, I don't remember this being a TV. I don't remember the Pitt-Jolie film being sold as based on a TV show. I don't remember the original TV show from which this IP comes. I honestly don't.
The IP isn't from the show, but it's the exact same premise with the exact same name.
Okay, this is interesting. So with this new one, and I'm sure you're going to get to this, but are we going back to the TV show or are we taking this from the Brad Pitt Jolie joint?
I believe that there's a title, like I'll have to go back and check this for sure, but I'm pretty sure that Simon Kinberg, who wrote the screenplay for Mr. and Mrs. Smith, who claims that it's based off an original idea, I believe that he gets a created by credit.
Oh, wow. Okay. This is complex. Why is this show so worth it? Why is there a positive buzz about this show, Dan Barrett?
Okay. So look, this is an interesting program in itself in that back in, I'm going to say like January or February of 2021. So we're talking 3 years ago, they announced this program. It was going to be a remake of the Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie film, a film which quietly I didn't like, but anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Me neither.
But they announced this. And what was exciting about the idea of a Mr. and Mrs. Smith TV show was that it was going to team up as the titular Mr., Donald Glover, and then as the titular Mrs., it was going to be Fleabag star herself, and I can't think of her name right now. Simon, help me out
here. Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
Phoebe Waller-Bridge. Yep. The two of them playing the Mr. and Mrs., and they get involved in all sorts of spy hijinks. 2021, you're looking at these two stars who are really TV auteur royalty. These were actors who are writing their own material, starring their own material, and not just material, but critically beloved material that was resonating with audiences. Both had such a cool factor about them that it's like Donald Glover and Phoebe Waller-Bridge on screen together in a show that they've kind of co-created and are, you know, running. Like, this is very exciting. And based on Mr. and
we
Mrs.
should
Smith,
point out at this point.
Well, I was going to say, sorry, based on Mr. and Mrs. Smith, who could have seen this coming? But like neither of them could do anything wrong. Donald Glover could do no wrong at that point. Phoebe Waller-Bridge could do no wrong.
Atlanta.
Yeah, we know the filmography, Simon. It's okay. But this is okay, it. Hugely exciting. And then, like, within the next year or so, Phoebe Waller-Bridge is like, I don't think I'm going to do this anymore. And then, basically, like, that's... Look, she's 50% of the partnership, but once either of them drop away from this project, that's 90% of the interest gone. Like, it is about the fact that it was these two specific auteurs together is what sold this. Now, they replaced Phoebe Waller-Bridge with Maya Erskine, who people would know probably best for Pen 15, or Penis, as the joke really is.
Oh, that show. I don't know her at all. I didn't know the name. I don't know the face.
Okay. Well, she's from that. And Simon, if you had watched one of the best TV shows of last year, which was the Netflix animated show, and oh gosh, the name just dropped out of my head. It's Blue Eye Warrior? Blue Eye Samurai. Blue Eye Samurai.
Yes.
Yeah, which you should watch because it's very good. She was the voice and had a bit of a creative sort of sway in that. Maya Erskine, generally pretty cool. Put her on screen with Donald Glover, and the one thing that you can definitely say about the two of them are they are both actors appearing in a TV show that have no chemistry at all, which is a little bit of a problem for this program.
That's a problem.
But the thing is, that's also the only problem with the show, because the rest of it all is pretty good. What we've got here is a program where it completely pushes aside what you may have expected from a show like this, say, 5 years ago, with a, it's Mr. and Mrs. Smith, the TV show. Here's the 8-episode storyline where, you know, they encounter something in episode one, and then by episode 8, they've kind of gotten involved in whatever. Like, it's not an ongoing story. It is episodic. Like, it is like old school TV. If you were to create a TV show called Mr. and Mrs. Smith and not have it star Maria Bello and Scott Bakula, but instead two contemporary actors, it's kind of the same thing. And it's really fun. There's lots of good support, good beloved actors who crop up through this. Paul Dano's there in, I think, the second episode as their next door neighbor. That's pretty good. Michaela Cole's in it. John Turturro's in the second episode. There's a whole bunch of faces that crop up regularly through this. And you'll be very excited to be watching it because they're all really cool, fun people in it. But what you don't have at the center of this program is Phoebe Waller-Bridge and Donald Glover. If you know what this show could have been, and look, I'm not even like a crazy Phoebe Waller-Bridge fan. Like, I think she's fine. Like, I liked Fleabag. I didn't love Fleabag. Donald Glover, I quite like, I don't love. But the two of them on screen together, I love the idea of that. And we don't have that. Instead, we've got a lesser version of what could have been. And knowing that really sort of deflates my interest in this quite a fair bit, especially considering that Maya Erskine just doesn't really have that chemistry with Donald Glover. Like, they get so close to having it at times. There's like little like fun moments where the two of them sort of really just edge against each other, and then it's gone in a blink of an eye.
Do you think it's a height thing? And we'll touch on this later in the birthday quiz, but Donald Glover, he's a short man. And Phoebe Waller-Bridge is like 6'7" or 6'6" or something. So even that kind of chemistry would have been fun to see them play off. But in the photo we're using for this week's sort of fingernail that we put on the Facebook page and on the YouTube channel, you can see that Maya Erskine is considerably shorter than Donald Glover. And thinking maybe I'm over-laboring the point here, but it would have been fun to see Glover looking up to Phoebe.
I mean, I didn't realize you were so shortest generally in your approach to life, but you know, here we are.
Don't get me started on short people.
Look, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, you know, if we were going to be sort of really gross and give it a score out of 10, like, it's probably a 7 out of 10. It's a really good program. By the end of the first, I was a bit iffy on the show when it first started, and like, I was already coming into it from like a very skeptical level, and the show did win me over by the end of the first episode. Unfortunately, the second episode doesn't live up to the potential that first episode really sort of delivers. But it's still very watchable. It's still pretty fun. And I reckon anyone who gets through and sees the plot mechanic sort of unveil in that first episode. Sorry, I don't want to say too much there. There's something interesting that happens in it. You know, I think that people will be more or less in on this. But yeah, it takes a little bit of time. And I just don't buy them as... like, they're not supposed to be a couple. They're two spies working together who may potentially become a couple. But yeah, so it does, it does waver from the movie concept.
You didn't like the movie? Well, see, I didn't like the movie either. And I thought the movie was well, actually, I'm about to get into my review of Argyle, and maybe it's some of the same reasons, but I found the movie to sort of lack energy despite it being such a frantic film. And I remember walking away thinking that was a missed opportunity, but it was a huge hit and certainly got things started for Brad and Angelina, and it led to, you know, dozens of children being adopted, I should say. So why didn't you like the film? Can you recall?
It's actually probably for a very similar reason. I just thought it was really flat. I just didn't really find anything particularly engaging about it. I didn't find the two of them necessarily steaming on screen together. It was just, you know, it was just content.
Yep. True. All right. Mr. and Mrs. Smith, the TV show, is on Amazon Prime as we speak. Simon, worth having a look, we'll see if it wins you over.
Can you see on my screen here, I've got a picture of the original Mr. and Mrs. Smith. Look at the tension between the two of them. These two are smoking on screen.
That is a rocking photo. That is a hot photo. Bacula bringing all the Bacula charm. And Maria Bello, always been a fan, but that's a smoking photo. Where did you get that? How did you have that handy? What are you doing with that photo?
Stop asking questions. What I can say, though, and this is really just getting tangential, I was thinking the other day about the way that TV shows at the moment, like there is definitely a trend we're experiencing right now where we're moving away from, I guess, maybe the trappings of prestige TV. Okay. So as we started moving more towards a cable model, which then in turn led towards this on-demand streaming binge model that everyone sort of has really sort of fallen into. Okay, it kind of felt as though all TV shows were working to a season-long arc, and TV was losing its episodic nature, okay, and losing maybe a fair bit of the fun that exists in TV, really adhering to an episodic nature. It does feel like in the last couple of months, a lot of the TV shows that are being commissioned, a lot of the shows which are getting a fair bit of heat, are episodics, and I don't remember where I was heading. Oh, sorry, I started thinking about like the last wave. Well, Poker Face is probably a really good example of it. But yeah, like this season, like all the shows that people are really talking about are leaning towards more of that episodic nature. Okay. And like with Poker Face, it was being sold on the novelty of returning back to the episodic. But I think that the novelty is past. I think we're just heading back into episodics, which I actually really like. I really like the economic. I'm putting the emphasis on the wrong parts of that word. But...
emphasis.
I guess the frugal storytelling that one sort of has within an episodic nature. Like you really are confining things to, I need to have my story established and provide some meat to it and wrap it up within about 40 to 45 minutes. Like that's actually really fun. And it's quite easy to sit on the couch and binge watch five or six episodes and think back to the idea of where prestige TV really kicked off, which is things like The Sopranos and Oz and then few years prior with network TV of ER and Homicide: Life in the Street and, you know, all the obvious titles, they're all episodics. It only feels as though TV's gotten really bloated in the last 5 years. So we're returning back to what made TV good. But to get what I actually talk about here, I was thinking about like that changeover period where we went from episodics to this sort of more season-long sort of run. And I started thinking about Maria Bello. Do you remember she starred in one of the last sort of big budget episodic efforts to try to be prestige TV on network? She starred in the US remake of Prime Suspect.
Yes, I did. Yeah. I do remember. I do recall. I was a big Maria Bello fan. Still am a big Maria Bello fan. Coyote Ugly, please. Come on, baby.
Yeah, no, she's great. First noticed her really in, I think, ER back in the day and then sort of went on from there. Sure. But the big gimmick in her Prime Suspect was she used to get around wearing a hat and used to like take it off and twirl it around a bit. Anyway, side thought.
That's good character work.
Argyle.
Yeah, speaking of frugal storytelling and keeping things to 40 minutes, let's segue into Argyle.
I certainly hope you dance as well as you dress.
There's only one way to find out.
You and I, we're not so different. Agent Argyle.
Simon, was that a bit of a joke there before we flipped to the clip saying keep it in 40 minutes? Because my understanding is this movie goes for about 3.5 hours.
It goes for 2 hours and 20. Let me just cast our minds back to all those people who listened to our end of year wrap last year when I made the point that maybe that some of the worst movies that had come down the pipe in 2023 were the heavily star-laden, bloated streamer action films, things like Ghosted with Ana de Armas and Chris Evans, and that horrible Gal Gadot thing, and those two horrible Chris Hemsworth things that were on Netflix. Show movies which went way too long in the service of totally underwhelming stories and are just big money earners for the talent involved and have no other value whatsoever. And that brings us to Argyle, which is the new cinema release, although Apple-backed action film starring Bryce Dallas Howard, I didn't think I'd say that in an action film, as the author of a series of spy novels starring her agent Argyle, played in flashback, or I guess imaginary form, by Henry Cavill wearing a green velvet suit. Not such a bad thing, but with the most stupid-looking haircut ever seen on an action star, throwing him back to that early 90s Brian Bosworth sort of spiky hair kind of phase. If you know who Brian Bosworth is, you're a better man than I am. This is a story that takes 2 hours and 20 minutes, and I use the word story lightly, to create a whole lot of mayhem and a whole lot of frantic action by director Matthew Vaughn, who I love from his work on the Kick-Ass movies, but I don't love from anything else he's done, which has primarily been the Kingsman film. He's sort of been trapped within that franchise for the last decade or so. With this one, he uses a whole lot of very tinny, very shonky-looking special effects and CGI work to create this frantic action film that puts Bryce Dallas Howard and her offsider, played by Sam Rockwell. And I tell you what, there's a very thin line between charming Sam Rockwell and bored and uninterested Sam Rockwell. And you know which one we get in Argyle. And also create a few sort of minor characters so that Apple can throw a whole lot of dollars at people like John Cena and Ariana DeBose, who won the Oscar for West Side Story, and Bryan Cranston chewing the scenery like we've never seen Bryan Cranston do before as the bad guy here. And the faint glimmer of goodness in this, which is Catherine O'Hara. But then continually throw plot twists and pull the carpet out from under the viewer with a whole lot of ridiculous moments and ridiculous plot machinations, which make no sense and which suck the fun and suck the tension out of this to the nth degree. By the time he gets to his... And it takes a long time to get to his big action extravaganza CGI heavy finale. I found this such a cumbersome, tiresome, convoluted action wannabe that I was sitting in the cinema chair, hand on my face, just wishing it would be over. You've seen Dua Lipa a lot in the trailer, and that was probably the reason that I got out to see this. Big Dua Lipa fan. Everything you've seen in the trailer is everything you see of Dua Lipa in the film. She's gone after the first few minutes. I don't care if that's a spoiler. The more people I save from seeing this film by giving away spoilers, the more I'll be thanked when people finally do catch up with the movie. Argyle, I know it's only the first week of February. This feels like a February movie in that it's just filling a void while the Oscar films have their run and there's nothing else out there to see. But Argyle is about as awful a movie as I've seen in a long time.
I don't even know what a Dua Lipa is, to be completely frank.
Google it. I do it constantly. The kids will know who Dua Lipa is, and they'll probably rush out to see this, hoping that they'll see her through a 2.5-hour movie. You don't. You see her for about 15 minutes, and then these poor kids have got to sit through the next 2 hours of crud. What's happened to Matthew kids... Vaughn? He had made such a great film with Kick-Ass and then has just been caught up in trying to remake the feel-good action of this. The other thing about this is I think Apple demanded that they wanted a PG-13 film. So the big bullet hits and the really hard-hitting slow-motion action for which he was rightly praised for Kick-Ass is all gone. It's just this terrible, terrible CGI.
Yeah, there's a TV show which debuted last week called Expats, which, look, I'm going to play a little clip from it, which we don't usually do in this segment, but I think it's probably worth doing for this one.
I just sometimes want to be alone, where I'm not somebody's wife, not somebody's mother, where I'm not defined by tragedy.
Don't you ever miss it? Home?
I like our life here. The help the driver said makes everything easier.
I see his family.
You know you always say that, right?
You're her employer, not her friend.
Now, Simon, I'm pretty sure you've seen this program as well. This was last week's big Prime Video release. It stars Australia's own Nicole Kidman as one of three expats who are living in Hong Kong in 2014. There is a mystery component to the first episode, which gets resolved in the second episode, which I think is a bit of a stumble for the program, but we'll get back to that in a second. But largely what's happened is a personal family tragedy has befallen the Nicole Kidman character and her family. They are dealing with the repercussions of that while living in this apartment building with another lady who, also an expat, is having some, I guess, reproductive challenges with her husband, although there's really just relationship issues taking place there for all sorts of reasons. And then there's a third mysterious woman that's part of their lives, and I don't really reveal why until that second episode. This is a show which, first of all, it's probably important to note that Lulu Wang is the person who's created this program and directs every episode of it. Lulu Wang is the writer-director of The Farewell, which is an indie film from a few years ago that lots of people latched onto and really loved. Yeah, so anyone who checked that out, like expats, is kind of a must-watch, I think, based on that. Lulu Wang, like, she knows what she's doing. The show has two problems that I had trouble grappling with, which was the first one, and it's kind of what I was talking about with Mr. and Mrs. Smith, in that TV's moving back to an episodic nature. This very much goes at the season as being a season-long storyline to watch through and experience the full limited series nature of it by the end. And there's nothing wrong with doing a show like that, obviously. But where I think the show struggled a little bit was I don't think it considered the viewing experience of playing around with the linear nature to meet the episode requirements of an 8-episode limited series. So we see this mystery set up in the first episode of this younger woman, how is she involved in it? And then in the second episode, we just see it. And the problem is that people are watching episodes 1 and 2 largely back to back, either in one sitting or, a couple of days apart, probably. Yeah, Amazon Prime Video released the first 2 episodes on the same night, so presumably people watch both of them. And so you just don't really understand why it is that you have to wait an hour to suddenly see what happened, what was that, 18 months prior or 2 years prior, whatever the time difference is. Yeah, I think it's like 2011, so it might be a 3-year time difference. Like, you don't really understand why. Like, it's just confusing when elements of that initial storyline, of the precipitating storyline, the thing that kind of really kickstarted the whole thing, why wasn't that just woven into the story from the beginning? It didn't add anything to the story. Instead, it actually felt slightly frustrating to go through that experience of reaching an hour and it's like, oh, here's what happened before the hour you just watched. And it's like, well, you just wasted a lot of time setting up a mystery, which you've just answered. Like, it's kind of a bit annoying, but
I think
that sets
up the final episodes really well. I think it's a great way to launch 2 episodes almost as a self-contained narrative, but with so many questions left unanswered that can spin the story off into a lot of really interesting ways.
You can set up the questions, you just don't set up the mystery and then just resolve it in the next episode by doing a flashback. Like, it's just a frustrating experience. And you're coming at it from someone who watched the screeners and could watch it all in one hit. That's not how it's released. And so that's where the problem is. The actual experience.
No, I only watched it on Amazon Prime. I haven't got access to Amazon screeners. So I literally only watched it.
Oh, sorry, I thought you were saying that you saw it through the end. But for most of that second episode, you just kind of feel like you've just had like an hour of your life wasted because it's just paying off everything that was just set up as a question. Like, it's just kind of a weird way to structure it. And look, maybe as the series goes on, like, part of that structure will become a more integral part and like it'll start to make sense. But that viewing experience at the beginning, I just found it. If the show wasn't of such a high quality and wasn't so compellingly watchable, I'd be writing the show off as a result of that. But it's hard to dislike the show based on, I guess, just how good it is. The second thing that I think is a problem for it is Nicole Kidman. Now, if this show, and I know you disagree with this, but we have to look at culture that it's not in a vacuum, okay? It's part of it's a continuum of experience and elements that we're taking away from things. Nicole Kidman has played the same sitting very upright, not quite an ice queen. And this, she's actually a little bit looser than we've seen in like her last like four or five limited series. If you think about that time period from when she first started appearing on cinema screens in the US, telling people to love movies, and then you watch all the many TV shows she's created since she started doing that, and then reach this one here, she's kind of played the same sort of character all the way through. I'd like to see a Nicole Kidman who slouches every so often. That'd be really nice. Instead, what we have here is just her, what, like fourth or fifth limited series in a row where she's kind of just doing the same thing. And I've seen those other shows and I'm just kind of tired of it. Like, I kind of wish they'd cast somebody else in this role to play this kind of a character, just because I need that element of freshness in the mix. And it's not quite there.
Without
so introduce the stale element. Well, just introduce the stale element, something that actually feels fairly fresh and vibrant otherwise.
Without giving away too much of the story, in this one she plays a woman who is eaten away from the inside by grief and still dealing with the tragedy of what's befallen her family. I think the physicality she gives this role is some of the best work she's done in a long, long time. And I don't think it's fair to say that the roles that she's taken on in her last sort of slew of TV small screen productions are the same. I think there's quite a bit of variance in the performances. She's a very technical actress, and I get why there's some sort of kickback against, there's a chilliness about her on the screen, because she's that NIDA trained. And Naomi Watts is kind of the same. It falls in the same sort of boat with her performance in the Capote story. They're cut from the same cloth. It's no surprise that they're two best friends in real life, because they do very much share an acting style that can be seen as really chilly. I think Expats is some of the best work that Nicole Kidman has done in a long, long time, and is some of the, especially in the range that she covers from almost backwards, from the second episode when she's on the boat with the kid and meets the potential babysitter, back to the skeletal woman, and that incredible dance sequence that she does in the noodle bar with the other actress, and sort of gives you a little bit of a relief from the grief that she's feeling, I think is a pretty mesmerizing bit of television, thanks to her. So, yeah, I disagree with you, but I know that Nicole Kidman is a divisive sort of figure.
Look, I think incredible dance sequence is probably a little generous, but broadly, and it's this thing about sort of being in a bubble. Like, I don't disagree. I think this is the best that she's been in really quite some time. Unfortunately, it's just coming off the back of a couple of years of her constantly being a presence in these limited series with performances that I think are just kind of a bit of a similar mold. So if there'd been a break of a couple of years between them, I wouldn't have been anywhere near as harsh. But like, I just came to this. It's like, could you not have cast somebody else in this role for this time? It's unfortunate.
The range shows in Aquaman 2 is what really impresses me. That if you want to see a great Nicole Kidman performance, get along and see Aquaman 2.
Oh, look, there's probably no scenario where I'm going to go and see Aquaman 2. But, you know, broadly, yeah, look, I've just seen a whole bunch. Just as an aside, like completely as an aside.
Yes.
I was going to say, news today came that there's a second season of Nine Perfect Strangers being released. She was obviously the main character in the first season, which I never saw through to the end of the season. So I don't know if she would be part of the second season or not. Who knows? Could she be?
Yeah, she'll be there.
Yep. She'll be there. Okay.
Yeah.
But the second season, they've apparently gotten a fair bit of funding money from Germany and Austria, which means that the show will be filmed there instead of around Byron Bay in Australia. And so I'm wondering, will they still try to pass off Austria and Germany as being Southern California in the same way they did Byron Bay with its very native Australian fauna?
Why? Talking about green screen work in Argyle, that'll take some green screening for sure. Very quickly, I got along to the movies and finally caught up with the surprising box office favourite. I won't say it's a hit. It's topping out at about $70 million in the US as we speak, which I guess is above expectations for a movie like Mean Girls. I was a huge fan, still am a huge fan of the Lindsay Lohan Tina Fey film from, 20 odd years ago now. That freaks me out. I was kind of dubious about seeing Mean Girls. As you know, it's a couple of weeks into its cinema run, so I didn't rush out and see it first week. But I got to say, I adored this film. I am instantly a Renee Rapp fan. She plays the part that Rachel McAdams played, Regina, in the original series. And while in the original movie, while this isn't as sharp-tongued or as acid-tongued as the comedy was, it certainly still plays into the click element that the first film made so much fun of. The songs are actually pretty terrific in this. The one thing this did miss, I think, was Lindsay Lohan's central figure and Guri Rice, the Australian actress, who's very lovely and very fine in this version of the film, doesn't have the same sort of edginess to her that Lindsay Lohan brought to the original film. So it's lacking that little bit of element. But it still sort of plays enough with high school types and high school cliques that it's an effective update of the original story while still being a terrific musical as well. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of Mean Girls. I saw Renee Rapp do her thing on Saturday Night Live the other week when Jacob Elordi was hosting, and I thought she was great on that. So that's part of the reason I didn't go out and see this one, and everything worked for this movie. So I can see why it's being very popular with the target audience.
Yeah, no, going to get this on a big miss. I don't really understand why it exists. And look, I love that first film, but I just don't know. Why would I go and see this? Or?
Well, what do you mean why you don't know why it exists?
Yeah, well, why are they making a movie remake of a film which is still broadly played on TV all the time just because there was a Broadway musical version of it? Like, I just don't see the value proposition in this at all.
Come on, Dan. We've spent the last 3 years of this podcast talking about Batman and Superman. Why? I mean, there's always reworkings of origin stories. Why is Mean Girls any different?
Well, isn't this the exact same story but with songs?
Well, no, there's all different variations from the original movie that have helped it turn into a musical. But yeah, I mean, stories can be retold for different generations.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's actually being retold for a different generation. I kind of think it's the same generation that grew up watching it for the last 20 years on home media that are going to the cinema to see this. But anyway, Simon, I wanted to fact check your Mean Girls box office, which was wrong, but I won't delve into that too much. The interesting box office story.
Three weeks at number one in the US and straight to the top.
Well, yeah, but through some pretty low taking. Look, I wasn't going to talk about the numbers, but if we're going to do that now, Simon, 3 weeks during some very low box office weeks. So it's topped out about $61 million domestic.
That's 3 weeks. Yeah,
okay.
3 weeks at number one.
Yeah, my fact checking was going to be that you
said midweek by the Beekeeper.
Okay, Simon, my fact checking was going to be you said it was $70 million. It's actually more $60 million with a worldwide of $85 million. But the more interesting story here is anyone but you. And the continued juggernaut that this has proven to be. Simon, how much money do you think this movie has made worldwide so far?
I don't know about worldwide. I know in the US it's at about 66 on Box Office Mojo yesterday afternoon. So, and the incredible story behind that is that the TikTok marketing that has been
I don't buy that.
For them.
I'm not sure I buy that. I think that at the moment, they're reaching around trying to work out why is this movie so popular? So first of all, to actually answer that question about the worldwide box office, it's currently up to $128 million worldwide off a budget of like $7. Yeah. Okay, like this film is doing absolute gangbusters. The reason why I think it's doing so well isn't just because, people have heard a song on TikTok and so therefore they're going to go and spend $20 at the movies and, you know, spend 2 hours to see this thing.
There's been a very specific marketing campaign by Sony Pictures to the TikTok audience to win them over. It's been really well documented how heavily Sony have gone into TikTok marketing to make this a must-see film.
I don't know. All I know is that I went to the cinema and saw this, was it 2 weeks ago I said I saw this? Which is a few weeks after release. And the people in the theater were a mixture of younger people who probably may have had some sort of TikTok exposure, maybe. But it was broadly a lot of older people. And I think the reason why this is doing so well is actually just for, like, old school movie reasons, which is people are always surprised when something comes out of nowhere. But more often than not, it's because it's counter-programming. There's no other rom-coms really out on the market. There haven't been any sort of traditional feeling rom-coms out there for years. I think it's just a hunger for a rom-com. I think it's a movie that has two fairly appealing leads in it. Sydney Sweeney's hugely popular right now for both women and men, different reasons, sometimes crossing over, I'm sure. But broadly, you know, she's very much the it girl of the moment. Glenn Powell's got like a, you know, higher stature off Top Gun, but I think that him appearing on screen in these trailers with Sydney Sweeney has elevated his, you know, profile considerably. I think people have seen the dopey trailers for it and thought, you know what, that looks kind of fun. I'll never bother going to see it. But then I just think that like 6 weeks of just not very good movie releases and people just going, I've kind of heard this is okay. I kind of got a good feeling while I saw the trailer. I think people are just getting along and seeing it. It's one of those old school long tail movie releases at a time period where, because of strikes and all sorts of other reasons that have impacted release schedules, there's just not much on. I think people are looking for escapism right now. People are feeling financial pressures. Like, there's just all sorts of reasons. A dopey rom-com's exactly what they want.
And this speaks to the point that I sort of raised when we were looking at where's the box office windfall going to come from in 2023 with such a huge sort of scarcity of product. Things will emerge, and you'll find that Mean Girls is all of a sudden going to like top out at about $80 million in the US, which is good for those sort of films. Anyone But You is going to sort of creep its way up to $170 million by the time it's out of cinemas around the world. And there's going to be these sort of mid-level performances that would have been just disappeared in the shadow of the blockbuster releases of years gone by, who that are going to sort of make up, whether they make up the blockbuster numbers that another Marvel film at the peak of its power was going to do, but they will emerge. They will come out. The Beekeeper, I just sort of half mentioned it before, this new Jason Statham film is also finding surprising legs, $100 million around the world that nobody expected to happen. So nature finds a way.
Yeah, whether nature will be in... This is, I guess, part of the problem for movies generally is that there's been such a large amount of money spent on upgrading cinemas so that, you know, there's not just like in the sort of independent, not just like in a per theater thing where suddenly everything's become VMAX and with comfier chairs and whatnot, but there's just more cinemas around the place. More of those cinemas have like more screens than they used to have. And so much of the exhibition space has been orientated around the business model associated with these large Marvel or Star Wars or like Fast and Furious size blockbuster releases coming out at such a regular clip that, you know, sort of propelling this forward. While it's probably good for the long-term health of exhibition that there are movies that aren't just like big blockbusters that are actually bringing out audiences, I do wonder whether or not the exhibition industry has just changed in terms of its financial structure and what it needs to support that. And can these movies make that up? And, you know, neither of us are really equipped to be able to answer that. But that's, I guess, maybe the question that needs to sort of be considered as you think about the health of movies going forward. But I want to move on to one last thing very quickly, because we've already talked about this a few times in the past in the podcast, but I finally got along to see Anatomy of a Fall, which is the new French art house. Yeah. I'd call it a smash hit because how often are we really talking about sort of French cinema releases? As much as I dislike the French and their film festivals, I really quite like this movie. It's 2.5 hours long. It felt like 90 minutes. Like it really was such a captivating, absorbing film. Just as a, you know, God bless the cinema experience with the guy who decided to get onto his phone right towards one of the crucial court case scenes right at the end of the movie. That guy, a complete champion. That's thank you very much for, mate. Oh, that guy, Simon, that guy. And nobody said anything to him, even though everyone was clearly annoyed in the cinema. If I was closer to him. But anyway, Simon, if broadly anyone who may have just ignored Simon's sort of rapturous review of it, swing back, take a look at this film. I just think what's fascinating about the movie is, I guess, the impact that it had on my cinema attending group when we went and saw it. It led to a really robust discussion at the end of the movie, which I can't remember the last time we went and saw a movie which actually inspired that. I mean, largely it was inspired because one of my friends just doesn't understand how to read movies and just didn't understand what the movie was telling us at the end. But it still led to a very robust, fun conversation at the end. And I just, you know, really appreciate that. I'll tell you about it after we finish the podcast,
Simon. It's a great film and ideal for that.
It really is.
Anatomy of Fall is, and you're right, it's finding a good audience around them, perhaps.
Well, what I found particularly sort of compelling about it, and it's the reason why I actually like watching a lot of French cop movies and legal procedurals, is that their structure is so wildly different to the Westminster system or anything that you see on like these US procedurals as well. I've spent the last few months watching a lot of LA Law, and then to go and watch Anatomy of a Fall, where their courtroom systems are so much more, it's not adversarial. I mean, it kind of is, but a lot more of it's a conversation. And it's a lot of going backwards and forwards and asking each other for context and explaining things and having jokes with each other and just treating each other like human beings. It's very earthy. And it's, I don't know, it struck me like, you know, I've seen this presented in like a couple of movies. So like, it's not like I'm an expert on this by any means, but it certainly seems like it's a better system. And so, I don't know, it was really fascinating to watch it from that perspective.
Let's jump forward by going backwards. It's this time in history. February 3, 1953, the NBC Today Show introduces a new regular contributor, one J. Fred Muggs. Now, what was so unique about J. Fred Muggs?
I love the idea that you might be sitting there thinking, oh, Dan will never get this. But come on.
I know Dan.
J. Fred Muggs. He was a monkey.
A chimpanzee, to be precise, but yes, I'll accept monkey. I don't know what he contributed, but I guess he was sort of a funny aside. But anyway, J. Fred Muggs, God bless you, wherever you are right now.
He was a presence on the NBC Today Show for a couple of years. Like, I wouldn't say he was co-hosting segments, but like he was around on the set and did a whole bunch of things.
Flinging feces at guests.
The movie Quiz Show references him at one point. But he's like one of these great sort of American, quirky... Sorry, what's that?
And I guess Nope does as well. I guess the sort of subplot in Nope where the chimpanzee kills all the family on screen probably was taken from...
No. So, look, that's probably besmirching J. Fred Muggs. At no point did anyone die on the set of the Today Show. I mean, lots of people have died on that set.
Muggs is a multiple killer, but yeah, okay, yeah, that's true.
No.
All right, let's go on to
the reason I know J. Muggs is because I've got a real fascination with that weird period of American TV from the beginning of TV, really, but like those early 50s through to the early 70s, where there were just a lot of chimpanzees on television. Things like Lancelot Link's Secret Chimp and all this kind of thing. Like, he's just part of that. So when Nope is talking about like the chimpanzee on the sitcom that went mad and killed a whole bunch of people, like, it's actually just kind of leaning into something which easily could happen on a sitcom where you've got a monkey co-star. It's just American TV. They love chimps.
We do love chimps. February 8, 1994. Who attacked a car with a golf club on this day?
Now,
who
I'm not
sure. Attacked a car with a golf club.
I'm not sure. I've got lots of questions about the answer I'm going to give because I don't know if it's 1994. I don't know if I'm confusing the sisters. I don't even know if this is even what we're talking about here. But could it have been like a Zsa Zsa Gabor?
No, not on this day, but she was famous for attacking a police officer.
That's what it was.
Some kind of weapon. But no, this was in fact Oscar-winning actor Jack Nicholson attacked a car with a golf club on this day in 1994, February 8. He was nuts for a while there. Now he's a bit of a recluse. But yes, Zsa Zsa Gabor certainly had a moment, as did Mel Gibson, who we may not talk about ever again. February 9th, 1979, which film from tough guy director Walter Hill premiered to gang violence and a police presence at many theatres showing the film? This one is an absolute tough guy classic of the period. But inspired gang violence and a police presence at many theatres.
Okay, now I'm pretty certain this movie's The Warriors. Is that right?
Bing, well done. Yes, it is The Warriors. Come out to play. Yep.
Well, it's a film I've never seen, but I always saw like the video cover at the local video store as a teenager, and I always meant to rent it out, and I just never did, and I regret it to this day.
Oh, Dan Barrett. You have homework for next week, my friend. Watch The Warriors. Okay, birthday quiz.
No, not happy birthday. No, not that. Please, no. Not happy birthday.
All right. Good insert there. February 3, 1976, Isla Fisher. February 3, 1970, Warwick Davis. February 8, 1974, Seth Green. And February 8, 1968, the late, the great Gary Coleman. What you talking about, Willis? What do these four have in common? Bit of a tough week for quiz, for birthday quiz names. So it's a bit of a long bow to pull, but give it a shot.
All four of them were survivors of incidents in bicycle shops in the mid-80s.
What? I don't know to what you're referring, but I'm sure you're...
Okay, well, let me take another swing at this one. Okay, so one of two things. Either we are talking about the fact that all of them started out as child actors, which they did, or we might be referring to their diminutive nature, as all four of them are rather short.
Okay, well, yes, the answer is they are all rather short. They all are well below the global average height for their gender. For men, it's 175 centimetres or 5 foot 9 inches. All of those men are well below that. Warwick Davis at 107, Seth Green at 163, Gary Oldman at 142 centimetres. And for women, it's around 162 centimetres and Isla Fisher is just under that at 160. So yes, it is all fine talents, but it is that they are short people. Insert Randy Newman song. What's the bike shop incident?
It's the classic episode of Different Strokes where Arnold and his friend went to a bike store with a bike owner, well, bike store owner played by Gordon Jump, and his friend, who I want to say was Dudley, unless I got my characters confused, was molested and little episode. Arnold got away. Yeah. Okay. Classic episode.
Little Arnold didn't get away. Oh, I see what you mean.
Here's the thing. I know that you've got your shortest attitudes and agenda here. Okay, but I think that talking about global averages for each of these people is probably unfair. I mean, first of all, you shouldn't be judging people on their heights to begin with, so whatever. But the second thing is, like, surely it shouldn't be about, like, a global average, but really based on their ethnicity, because people from different areas around the world all have different heights. And
so racist.
So, well, it's not racist. It's just how, you know, physiology works. Like,
I don't base anything on ethnicity. I don't see height. I just see short people.
No, but you do see height. This is your problem. And you're creating fake yardsticks to be able to judge whether these people are quote unquote normal or not. So, you know, it's unfair to say that.
I don't use the term height when I'm talking about someone who's 160 centimeters. That's not height. That's like, haven't even really started growing yet. Oh, Jesus, I can't believe it.
Okay. Sorry, well, Dan, look.
This has been a long podcast.
Simon, it's 12:20 in the afternoon. It's not a long podcast. It's pretty standard. Folks, first of all, if you want to find me, you can hit me up at alwaysbewatching.com. I do a daily newsletter there where I talk about the world of TV, streaming, and film. It's a newsletter. It comes out 5.5 times a week. Also, if people subscribe to the newsletter and they would like to be my co-host on this podcast, I am looking for a new co-host. So just hit reply on there and just send me through some information about you and what you might want to talk about. That's probably all I really need to delve into there. We'll let the casting process begin. Simon, what about yourself? What would you like to plug?
Well, you know where to find screen-space.net, but also we've started selling tickets for the Melbourne season of the Melbourne Science Fiction Film Festival. I've taken your advice and actually named it after the city in which we're holding it. We'll be doing the same for our Brisbane seasons.
Yes.
So Melbourne, go to the Cinema Nova website where you can see all the movies and buy all the tickets to our Melbourne Science Fiction Film Festival. And, of course, if you're a fan of screen watching, you can find us on Facebook at Screen Watching Podcast, on Threads and YouTube at Screen Watching, or email us screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com.
Imagine that, being surprised that people didn't turn up to the Sydney Science Fiction Film Festival in Brisbane. They're just confused. They were like looking on their maps. It's like, where is the cinema?
Didn't come up in our marketing planning meetings that we should actually use the name of the city we're in to sell tickets rather than hoping that just calling ourselves something, people will come along. We live and learn. We live and learn. We're all new at this game. We live and learn. Dan Barrett, nice talking to you.
Yeah, likewise. Give me a call sometime before you spend on your marketing assets.
Bye-bye.
Bye.